I think this case really highlights that there's no bottom, right? Because when you think about that admissions decision, all of the rhetoric around it was like, you can get diversity in other ways. You just can't use race as a factor. Right. And now when you have high schools or law firms or any institutions trying to do that very thing, the extremist groups are coming after them nonetheless. And so I think that really highlights sort of the extremism that we're dealing with.
Welcome back to the DEI podcast. I'm Max Gaston. My guest for today is Sunu Chandy, civil rights attorney and senior advisor at Democracy Forward, a national legal organization that advances democracy and social progress through litigation, policy, public education, and regulatory engagement. In June of 2023, the Supreme Court issued its historic decision in Students for Fair Admissions v. Harvard, where it struck down affirmative action in college admissions. More than 1 year later, there's been a surge of cases filed in the courts against a variety of DEI initiatives, creating legal challenges that have made headlines and instilled fear among organizations and schools concerned about potential litigation. But aside from the media buzz, just how much have these lawsuits actually accomplished? Have they had any real impact in the courts? Or are they merely expensive distractions with more noise than substance? Sunu recently led a report at Democracy Forward that highlights key analysis and findings based on a review of over 70 cases brought against diversity, equity, and inclusion-related programs in a range of contexts. Our conversation will examine the findings of the report, which, as you'll hear, challenge conventional wisdom and reveal that the Students for Fair Admissions decision, while often weaponized by opponents, has not fundamentally altered the legal framework in most situations. Sunu is also the former legal director of the National Women's Law Center, the former deputy director for the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and a former attorney with the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So I was particularly interested in hearing her insights on the legal landscape of DEI more than 1 year after Students for Fair Admissions. Here is my interview with Sunu Chandy. Sunu, welcome to the DEI podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So you led the charge with Democracy Forward to review over 70 cases that have come up since the Students for Fair Admissions decision, challenging DEI-related programs. And before we dive into the report itself, can you just give us some background on how it is we got here to where we are? I mean, you know, in the last several years, with the murder of George Floyd, with the racial justice protests, we've seen a rise in support for diversity, equity, and inclusion and urgency to really advance those causes. But I think the backlash to that is what's caused the surge of litigation that we're seeing. So before we dive into the report, can you just walk us through how it is we got to where we are in the first place?
Yes, thanks again for having me on the podcast. Yes, the background here is, you know, after a much needed racial reckoning, many corporations, entities did increase their numbers of diversity, equity, and inclusion related programs and provisions, which, you know, barely scratch the surface in terms of what's actually needed to remove the very real and existing structural barriers against so many in our society. Those have been in place for decades and continue today in many explicit and implicit ways throughout all factors of our society and all contexts. And so as these programs have developed, many of them have helped to open doors, whether it's how a job posting is written or whether it's not requiring a college education. If that's not required for that job, there's so many ways that something as simple as a job posting can close doors or open doors. And so in that context, we have many of these programs and we have these sort of extremist organizations that have come forward with a range of attacks. And the one against the colleges and universities went all the way to the Supreme Court. And that's the Students for Fair Admissions decision with Harvard and North Carolina that came out a little over a year ago. That decision was limited to admissions. Yet and still, our extremist opponents have used that case to bring, you know, at the time of the report, maybe 70 or so cases. Now there's over 80 cases that my colleagues have really been doing a lot of work to summarize and capture and to do analysis with, to share out what really is going on in these cases beyond the headlines that we see.
Suda, before we dive into the report, can you shed some light on who these plaintiffs are? And what it is that we know about them that might inform the nature of these lawsuits against DEI programs that are being brought?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Edward Blum and the organizations that brought the initial case against the admissions, those sorts of organizations are the ones who have continued down this path. It's totally incorrect to think that these are sort of individual harmed people or people who just seek to sort of go to the courts to bring down diversity, equity, and inclusion. That is far from the truth. If you look at the cases, you see organizations Do No Harm, America First Legal, American Alliance for Equal Rights, Students for Fair Admissions, and the Pacific Legal Foundation. You see these players over and over again in the caption. And that leads directly to why, fortunately, many of these cases are being kicked out, right? Because sometimes they can't even come up with one named person who is actually harmed by the program or measure in question, right? And some courts in the Second Circuit have said, can you at least name one person? And this is not about, does the name have to be public, or can you at least tell the court there is someone here who got hurt? And often these organizations are unable to do that. Sometimes no one even applied for the program. And so our courts are not there for, you know, these extremist groups to come in and try to trash DEI. Right. There are some cases where they're individuals, but the vast majority of them are brought by these sorts of extremist organizations. You're right.
So I want to walk through the different sections of the report with you and explore some of the really interesting themes and the issues that are coming up in these cases that you outline. But first, can you start by giving a high level overview? What were the findings of your report, and what are some of the more interesting points that you want people to know about?
Right. So diversity, equity, and inclusion refers to a vast majority of programs, policies, and measures that entities can take. These are in the federal government, local government. They can be in the healthcare context, workplace, education. Almost sort of any sort of entity in society today can institute these measures as a way to remove barriers and obstacles for more of us to have opportunities. And that's basically the gist of it. And so sometimes that can mean, you know, setting up mentoring for folks who don't have it. It can be sort of very practical skills that folks might need to gain entry. It might be sort of networking opportunities. There are a range of ways that we can open doors. And that is what DEI work is all about. And so the vast majority of those measures are 100% legal. Just to give an example, if there are programs for those who are underrepresented in a particular field, take one of the law firm cases, right? They had a program for law students who are underrepresented. That is not specific to race, gender, any sort of protected identity. Right? That anybody can come and write in their cover letter about maybe they're from a rural area, maybe they're a first generation student, maybe they're the child of immigrants from anywhere. It really is not specific to any particular identity. Yet and still, these extremists came after that case even, right? So one takeaway is that, A, there are a range of programs, and there are a range of programs under attack. And that has nothing to do with the legality of any of those programs. And what's tricky here is, as with that law firm case, many, many of the cases have settled. When a case settles, there can be some implication that, oh, what was going on there was incorrect, and that's not the case. Entities settle for a host of reasons. Maybe their clients, you know, don't want to be bothered with that. Maybe they have sort of a range of opinions about it, but it has actually nothing to do with if the original program was legal. And so that's one of the things I want people to really walk away with, is knowing there could be perfectly legal programs where the entities choose to settle for a range of reasons. So do not make that assumption. The other thing is, Race-specific programs are difficult, but not always illegal. So even though after the Supreme Court case, you can no longer use race as its own factor in the admissions, you can look at essays that relate to someone's background and culture, and that can be part of the decision making. So the decision, as harmful as it was quite narrow. You know, and as we explained in the report, even like military academies the standards haven't changed there, right? That went up and the Supreme Court said, that's a whole different context. I don't know what we would do with that. We need to have
where was the difference there?
Right, exactly. So even something so close, and admissions, right, to an educational institution, it was like, I don't know, that might be a different. And so if that example should highlight for everyone that workplace, healthcare, all of these other areas are different. There are different legal frameworks that need to be analyzed. Now, to be sure, race-specific programs can be more difficult to legally defend, and you have to look at each of these sectors and what the standards are. You know, we can talk about grants, we can talk about workplace. Each of these is slightly different. Public versus private. These are all different contexts. But another takeaway is race-specific or identity-specific programs may be harder to defend, but they're not across-the-board illegal, which is another thing, another misperception people may have. So the largest takeaway is the vast majority of the programs are legal, despite the daily headlines where our extremist organizations have like filed something with the EEOC or filed something with the Department of Labor. There was a rash of filings that were letters, not even charges, just saying things like, this corporation said they wanted more women in leadership. This, you know, entity said they wanted to increase their numbers of people of color. Those sorts of aspirational statements are fully legal. If you want to know how hard it is to bring an employment discrimination claim after litigating that for 15 years, it's tough. You have to look at the actual job, who all applied, what all went to the decision. It's a pretty high bar. Just someone saying, you know, we hope to have more women in management is not going to mean any particular decision is made for an illegal motive. So that's some of the areas that we hope people will take away that, you know, there are extremist groups bringing this and sowing division. The vast majority of employees, employers, and people in this country support diversity, equity, and inclusion measures. And we need to be vocal about that support and very clear about where these lines are instead of painting with a broad brush and dismantling these very necessary programs.
And something I should have led with at the top was, so what we saw in the Students for Fair Admissions decision was essentially a striking down of affirmative action. So the use of race-conscious admissions, race as one factor among many factors in the admissions process. And as you mentioned, that decision was cabined within colleges and universities and didn't even include military colleges, but didn't extend to the public or private employment sectors. But nevertheless, there is a sort of chilling that we're seeing because of a concern that people have that they will be the precedent-making case that is going to then extend that decision into a broader sector. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think it's important to say, just taking employment as an example, it had already been generally, typically, impermissible to use race as a factor or a protected identity as a factor in an employment decision. That's been the law in general all along. However, asterisk, you can have a voluntary affirmative action program as an employer if you meet certain criteria, if there is sort of and some inequities happening in that particular space or market, you can create a program. And there are some parameters for that. And one of the main parameters is that you aren't totally barring other people from accessing the program. So if you look through those parameters and you want to create a program, that an employer can try to do that. As a practical matter, most employers have not gone that route for many years. And so you can look at the totality of a decision and think about what skills, background, experiences people have, which might well touch on any of their protected identities, but you cannot use those one of those identities as a factor, as the reason you hired someone. And so all that to say, this admissions decision did not change employment law. However, it put a spotlight on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in employment. And more to the point, these sort of our opponents, these extremist groups, have used this moment to cite SFFA in bringing challenges against these very, very different under every legal standard programs. So minority fellowship programs or programs that have mentoring or any host of programs, I think if they are specific to a protected identity, they have to be more carefully designed. But the legal framework is actually quite different.
And so you mentioned minority fellowships and mentorship programs. Why don't we go there next? So the report talks about lawsuits that were filed by the American Alliance for Equal Rights, where they sued Perkins Coie, Morrison Foerster, Winston Strawn, major law firms, over their diversity fellowship programs. And even though those cases did settle, it's notable that with certain cases, particularly with Winston and Strawn, the objections to their fellowship criteria were actually objecting to a race-neutral criteria. And even though the case, you know, like you said, it's settled and settling can have a lot of different implications, it's curious that a fellowship criteria that's not race-specific could still be targeted and result not necessarily in the firm winning the case, but the case actually getting settled and having to make certain adjustments to even that. Can you talk about what these legal challenges look like when they're targeting race-neutral programs as well as race-specific programs for fellowships and mentorship programs?
Yes, absolutely. I think this case really highlights that there's no bottom, right? Because when you think about that admissions decision, all of the rhetoric around it was like, you can get diversity in other ways. You just can't use race as a factor. Right. And now when you have high schools or law firms or any institutions trying to do that very thing, the extremist groups are coming after them nonetheless. And so I think that really highlights sort of the extremism that we're dealing with. And so, yes, in one of those law firm cases, it's just said, we are here to have this fellowship for those who are underrepresented. And as we discussed, that could include people across all identities, right? Similarly, if a high school changes its standards in terms of its barriers that might have kept out certain groups, or changes how their admissions work in terms of, you know, having the top high school students from a range of high schools. There's any number of ways that schools, K to 12 schools or other groups can adjust their criteria to remove some of the barriers. That can be done in ways that are race neutral and neutral as to all of the identities, and yet result in a more inclusive group of people. And that actually is the pathway forward if you don't want to take the legal risk of having a race-specific program. And so imagine how intense it is to then have these same extremist groups come after you for that program, which is set up in the way that they said, set it up that way. Don't do race-specific. Just, you know, you can do it some other way. If you do it some other way, they still come. And so I think that we've seen that in terms of the workplace. We've seen that in terms of the education space, where efforts are made to remove barriers and to have a more inclusive group of people. And those kinds of programs are under attack as well. Fortunately, when it's on the merits, those turn out, I think, well. But to your point, and as we've discussed, if you settle that case, it sends the message that maybe there was a problem there. Now, I do want to highlight that in all of those law firm minority fellowship cases, they ended up tweaking their program in a way that still allows consideration of the applicant's backgrounds, work in DEI or otherwise, having candidates who are committed to this sort of vision. And so there, again, there are other ways to get there, maybe analogous to the essays in law school, sort of describing the whole person so that you can think about what kind of communities you're setting up, whether it's a workplace or a school, and who's going to be part of that.
Can you talk about what criteria makes a race specific, or I guess even a race neutral program, something that is still legally sufficient, that can withstand the scrutiny of a court or any legal attacks that it might face?
Right. So I believe that a program that says we are focusing or targeting on those who are underrepresented is legally fine, because being underrepresented in a space is not a legally protected group. And so you have to have some tie to an identity in order to bring a lawsuit, such as discrimination. Mm-hmm. And also another point to make is that a lot of these lawsuits are being brought on Section 1981, which was, you know, created so that Black people would not be discriminated against in making contracts. And now that provision is being weaponized across so many different sectors, including employment, because these organizations do not want to file a charge with EEOC, right? Mm-hmm. And wait for their right to sue letter, because EEOC, in investigating this, would say this program is totally valid and they don't want to have that no cause finding and as they go to federal court with their case. So they are trying to avoid sort of the normal channels you would use for an employment discrimination case, and using this law that was created for Black people to be able to make contracts, weaponizing it and saying, well, this program involves contracts. Sometimes the programs don't even involve contracts and it's a stretch, but they're saying this involves contracts, so we're going to challenge this program based on 1981. And so even in, and I'll give one other example that we highlight in the report, there was a city program that was giving out arts grants. And again, they did not do anything that was identity specific, but they were saying usually the grants are given to very longstanding, established, like the symphony, the ballet, like large entities. And they wanted to be able to have a greater pool of applicants be, you know, allowed for these grants. And so they looked at the criteria and they gave some preference to newer organizations, smaller entities, ones with smaller budgets, right? All these things that would actually open the doors wider and had an impact of having more BIPOC focused or led organizations getting those grants, right? And there was a whole challenge around that, not a live lawsuit, but a challenge around that saying, well, if you did that knowing what the impact would be, that in itself is illegal unless you have a disparity study. That is not true. And those artists actually filed a charge with the Human Rights Commission of that city, and that commission agreed, but there was a whole conflict around that within that city's law department, and they ended up settling. But I like to give that example because you don't need a disparity study to show particular groups are having less or more unless you are trying to do something race specific. If you are just lowering the barriers and you are aware of how that lands on certain groups, that is not race-specific decision-making. Do you understand the difference? You're just aware. And that awareness is so critical to remove barriers. That's different from, we have 10 grants and 5 of them will go to organizations led by people of color. You know, 5 of them will go to LGBTQ groups and so on. That's identity-specific decision-making. If you lower the barriers so that more groups have access to a particular program, and you're aware that that is going to be the outcome of it, that awareness itself is not illegal. Does that make sense? Yeah. And so that is exactly what's needed, because if you're not creating an analysis about how your program works and who benefits from it and who has access to it, then you're not actually probably doing your job, you know, in government or outside to have an inclusive program.
And you mentioned somewhere in the report as well that under EEO laws, you do need to collect some of this data. Is that right?
That's right. So there's an EEO-1 report for companies, I think, with 100 or more employees to provide information about the identities of your workforce in particular roles and jobs. And actually, that was there's more to that where they asked for pay data that was in place and that was struck down by the Trump administration. And there was a lawsuit that Democracy Forward and National Women's Law Center filed that ended up meaning that those companies had to provide pay data for a couple of years. Putting the pay data piece aside, they are still required to provide identity-related data on who's in what roles. And that information is used by EEOC if they're doing a charge or if they're looking at a company to see about job segregation and the like. And so EEOC actually recently brought an action against, I think, 15 companies for failing to report and collect that data. This is really crucial because even those who are well-versed in this space have been asking me, are we allowed to collect data still? I mean, the backlash has gone so far that people are afraid to even figure out who's in our workplace. Do we need to do better about outreach or getting people in for interviews and so on? That's really important. Obviously, it has to be voluntary. You know, employees should be allowed to provide that information on a voluntary basis or, you know, from what you can observe or otherwise collect. But otherwise, I mean, that collection of data is so important for that self-reflection by an entity. And also, when you have to report it somewhere, sometimes you think twice. I mean, same with the pay data. If you're reporting pay data to EEOC that shows these wide disparities within the same roles, right? That might push you to do a pay equity audit. Do some analysis about how your pay structure works and create greater equality.
Yeah, it's one of those things, I think, that people look at diversity, equity, and inclusion, and they presume that these are really focusing on kind of soft criteria. We don't need to be concerned about discrimination. But having that information can be clarifying to an organization to insulate itself and make sure that it's complying and not discriminating against certain identity groups. I want to shift to...
Can I say on that point?
Yeah, please.
Another area that's coming under attack is just diversity training or EEO training.
That's exactly where I wanted to go. Yeah, exactly. So this idea of diversity trainings being something that are controversial and themselves have been attacked, not just facing legal attacks, but also people attacking the benefit of them. Why does an organization need to do these things? Can you talk about some of the attacks against diversity trainings in particular?
Yeah, I mean, this is an area where I have several threads, so let me try to stay organized. I mean, I think there was an Eighth Circuit decision recently, Henderson, where the court again said, you know, having individuals take anti-discrimination training is not a violation of anyone's First Amendment rights or any rights at all. And this is sort of necessary for the workplace. EEOC did an excellent amicus brief that breaks down how all consent decrees that they enter into have trainings as a component of it. Those are signed off on by courts on a regular and routine basis. There's absolutely nothing discriminatory about holding DEI-related trainings and equity and anti-discrimination trainings. More so, it actually helps companies to comply and actually avoid liability, as you are getting at, right? Because for certain kinds of claims, if you show you had a policy in place, employees had it, they knew what to do, and they didn't follow those steps, that is actually a defense. And so when that case came out in the sexual harassment context, but it applies across the board, that's when companies said, we better do this then, right? This is our way to get in front of problems ahead of time. It's the right thing to do. And it can allow you to avoid liability if that person doesn't use your process and then goes to court. Now, if that person said, I didn't use the process because these last three people used it and got fired, then they don't have to use the process. Mm-hmm. But if you are running sort of a good faith, you know, program to address and resolve discrimination complaints and an employee doesn't use it, that is help you in terms of avoiding liability as a company. So most sort of companies now have some sort of anti-discrimination training and programs. I think sometimes where there can be sort of tension around that is what kind of training is it? You know, obviously, if you have more hypotheticals and it's helpful for people to understand it, but sometimes that training might make someone feel uncomfortable if they've ever thought about white supremacy or racism against Black people and other people of color or LGBTQ rights. I want to highlight that EEOC put out recently a federal sector decision called Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, which is on page 15 of our report, which was so powerful because it was someone asking for a religious accommodation against attending diversity-related training about LGBTQ rights. And the court said that is not an appropriate accommodation because this is information everyone there needs to know. No one is asking this person to take on any particular beliefs. This is just about how we treat each other in the workplace. And you cannot get an accommodation out of learning how to respect your LGBTQ colleagues. And so I think that's a really powerful sort of marker that sets the right tone in terms of how workplaces are run and what religious accommodations are and are not. I mean, I brought many cases with religious accommodations, and that's an important part of our law, but it's not to then, you know, either create harm for others or to remove yourself from your regular workplace requirements.
Sunu, I'm curious if you could talk about some of the outlier cases, one of them in particular that you mentioned in the report, DePiero v. Pennsylvania State University, an outlier to the generally upheld legality of DEI trainings. So when we do see cases that say that DEI trainings are a challenge against the DEI training is allowed to proceed, what distinguishes those outliers from the general majority of cases that are upholding the right to have those trainings?
I mean, in an EEO-related training, just like anywhere else in the workplace, if you are allowing harassment to happen, that could create a hostile work environment. Right. And so it's not so much that there are some trainings that are illegal. It's more so if harassment's happening in any context in, you know, meeting that really honestly high legal bar of severe or pervasive. If that happens to be in the context of a training, then that person can have a claim that goes forward, just like in any other workplace context. So I don't think courts are going to be in the business of like looking through at the language of different slides and trainings and did this offend you or did that upset you? Because the standard for workplace harassment is actually very high. And, you know, as we bring those claims, we see many of those claims lose, even with very severe, you know, racial harassment, sexual harassment, or other kinds of harassment. Those cases often lose because the standard is so high and courts don't want to be in that sort of HR business. However, if harassment reaches a sort of a certain standard against any group, that person could bring a claim and go forward. And it doesn't matter that it was in the context of a training that doesn't sort of insulate you from liability. So less of an outlier, more so just repeating the general standard that hostile work environments are not allowed. And if it meets that kind of level, then someone should bring a claim and go forward.
That's really helpful information to know. So DEI trainings are, of course, one piece of a corporate DEI program, but they're not the whole thing. Programs can span a whole wide range of opportunities to build equity, establish belonging. And so the report talks about a number of high-profile companies like American Express, Starbucks, Amazon, Pfizer, that successfully defended challenges against their DEI programs more broadly. Can you talk about the key reasons that some of those challenges against those companies' programs failed and what it means for companies trying to defend their DEI programs in general?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. Many of those cases ended up with technical decisions that allowed the programs to continue, often on standing, right? So, and this goes back to my question of like, who's bringing the case? Did they actually apply for the thing? Are they actually injured? Are they actually someone who could be someone who would be appropriate for that program? I mean, some of the courts are saying, you didn't apply for the program, you didn't meet the other qualifications to be part of the program. This was a program where one of 30,000 people would get a grant. There's no reason to think that you would have been the one to get the grant. You can't just say, I should be getting this money. Like all of these sort of technical reasons that relate to who can bring a case and what's the point of the courts hearing this case, right? And so if there's no injury, there's no standing, then you can't be in court in the first place. What I am seeing as a trend, having looked at some of these cases as they continue, is that these extremist organizations are now taking it to the next level and going to the circuits, you know, and getting a mix of opinions about, you know, in the Second Circuit in the Do No Harm case, we have a good opinion saying, like, if you can't find one person who had a problem with this program, then why are you in federal circuit court challenging it, right? And they're fighting it. They're fighting it. They might be trying to get on Bach to say, no, we don't have to have any, even one person. We are just saying this is wrong. And that doesn't really line up with showing at least that someone has a harm, an injury that they're trying to cover. I think that's part of it. I think the programs run the gamut. Some of them are race specific. Some of them have tweaked their programs. And this was a very interesting trend that I saw, having looked at the updates in the cases. Even where some programs have said, like in the Southwest case, okay, we're going to tweak our program. We're going to make it open to everyone. Let's just, you know, put this behind us. They aren't agreeing to that. They're saying, well, you might start the program again. And then in another case, the entity said, we promise we will never, ever, ever have this program again. They're still not settling. They clearly want to have a decision on the merits saying these sorts of programs must go away. And that has not happened yet, right? The one context that is more difficult is the government, the federal government programs. And these are a little tricky because they're not race specific, but they will say things like, this is a program for those who are so disadvantaged. And then there'll be information that says, if you are from these groups, you're presumed to be disadvantaged. So it doesn't close the door for others to apply, but it does sort of give like an easier pathway for some groups to access the funds or the programs. Those sorts of programs have come under challenge and attack, and there's been a range of outcomes, including some adverse outcomes. So I do like to say that as a little asterisk, as the one area where there have been decisions on the merits that are difficult. And, you know, we'll see what happens with those programs if the government continues to defend them. Some of them are PI level, and so we'll see what happens in the next stages. But again, that raises for me that some of these programs are so mild, right? If you look at the government boards programs, as government boards across the city, some of them have rules that just say, endeavor to have, you know, a body that's representative by all your identities. These extremist organizations have come even after those kinds of programs and rules, right? And they've said, and the rebuttal is, well, this doesn't even say we have to do this. This is just sort of aspirational. And those are fights that are continuing.
Sunu, this is less of a legal question, more maybe seeking your commentary on the state of society right now, but how do we reconcile, how do you reconcile the fact that a lot of the laws that are being used as a sword to attack diversity programs are the very same laws that were fought for and won, hard fought and won during the civil rights era? You know, the sort of irony that we find ourselves in, where things like Title VII can seemingly be attempted to be leveraged against the very communities that they were, that the law is intended to protect.
Yes, that is absolutely the case. And it has been sort of well presented to the courts in both the Fearless Fund case and also in, I think, Progressive Hello Alice is another case where our, you know, fellow organizations like Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights have submitted amicus briefs on the history of these laws and Section 1981 and how it came about and why it came about and why it was meant for. The mission and spirit of it is meant to allow Black people to enter into contracts, Right. And so to go from that history to now have our opponents weaponize that law to use against communities of color is really sort of, you know, ignoring the history of this nation. Having said that, through many of these civil rights, you know, precedents, courts have found that for many of these laws, they can be brought, cases can be brought by folks who are sort of like, as Justice Ginsburg brought, you know, if you're against sex discrimination, then men can bring those cases as well. And the same goes with race and many other factors. With age discrimination in the federal law, it's you have to be 40 or older. But with most of the provisions, these laws are to protect all of us. But I do think it's important to raise up sort of the origin of the law and the spirit of the law and the mission of the law as we see this weaponizing take place.
One of the things that you've talked about in the report, and you mentioned it earlier as well, were intimidation tactics that are sometimes used by some of these actors who would ultimately become plaintiffs. And so anti-equity actors like America First Legal have been sending demand letters claiming that DEI initiatives of certain companies, of certain universities, violate the law. How valid are those claims under existing workplace civil rights laws and EEOC guidelines? And how should organizations be responding if they receive something like that?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that, because not only are they sending letters to agencies and directly to companies, they're also like doing media and press around it, where often those letters are mistakenly called charges or complaints. I mean, I've seen a letter being referred to in the media as, oh, a federal complaint filed with EEOC, right? Which sounds very big and serious, when in fact, anyone can write a letter to EEOC. They have no obligation to do anything with it. That's very different from actually having someone who's harmed by discrimination filing a charge. A charge would have to result in some kind of investigation, unless it was frivolous, and some sort of decision on the merits or go through the regular EEOC process. Just sending a letter giving your opinion about a company's sort of aspirational statements about diversity, equity, and inclusion has zero legal weight. And I do think finally the reporters started to understand that and sort of give it less importance, because as that strategy began, it really sort of resulted in a lot of narrative around that, which is a big part of this, right? Even though we have the study saying employers are continuing this work, employees are seeking out companies that have commitments to DEI when they think about what jobs to take. When you look at the polling about, you know, people in America supporting inclusion, believing in opportunity for all of us, all these things are true, right? And yet you have this like narrative that, okay, we're done with diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is just not the case. But that is the message that these extremist groups are putting out, and it's taken hold. And so that's why it's important for, you know, audiences like the one who might be listening to this one to really share the report and share where there are caveats, where there are asterisks, where there are reasons to be careful, and where the vast majority of these programs are fully on legal, solid ground.
Have you seen an actual chilling effect in the programs that were trying to support diversity and inclusion? Or have you seen more of an adaptation of those programs so that they're race neutral, or that they're making efforts to be legally compliant?
Yeah, I think there's a mix. I mean, the other asterisk I want to give is some states have passed their own laws, which are more restrictive. And that's why it's very important to meet with lawyers as you figure out, you know, if you're coming up with your own programs and measures. There are some places where tweaks are necessary, right, to comply with state law. But in all the other places, I think some organizations may be overcorrecting just to avoid the spotlight or to avoid a legal fight, which I can understand as an entity, but I am really glad that many of the companies are sort of staying in the fight and not backing down and going through the circuit level and seeing what happens. And they always have to assess, What is the viability of that program under the current law? That is an important analysis to undertake, but many of them are legal. And if, you know, any reasonable sort of person who knows this area would look at it and say, that is something that should be defensible in court. And for that kind of a program, I'm hoping that more groups, you know, sort of stay steadfast and keep those going. I will. Do you want to talk about grants?
It's like you're reading my mind. That's exactly what I wanted to go to next. So one of the things that you note in the report is that after the Students for Fair Admissions decision, there have been attacks on grant programs that are focused on race and on gender, and programs for Black women, for example. And I was just wondering if you could talk about some of the examples from the cases and how those cases are impacting the administration of those grant programs.
Yeah, I think, and grants is another area where that law I talked about, 1981, has really been a big piece of it, because that, you know, that context, it's not public accommodations, it's not employment, it's not really, doesn't really fit neatly into an existing category where there are civil rights, you know, parameters. But grant programs is an area where our opponents have again weaponized Section 1981, and they've said, here's all the way this thing you're doing looks like a contract. And programs could be more or less like a contract. And, you know, usually there are some agreements back and forth, which then, okay, it looks like a contract, and then that law is in play. And so what happened with the Fearless Fund case is that, you know, they, with, for all the reasons that they've discussed about all of the ways that Black women have faced barriers in terms of accessing financial, you know, funds for their programs and projects and business endeavors, that's why they created this program, right? But when it went up to the circuit, there was a preliminary injunction saying, this does look like a contract, and it is race-based, and so this might not be, you know, legally sufficient. And so, you know, recently the case did settle and the terms were not provided in the court filing. You know, given the way that program is, maybe that was a good decision, because you don't want to have a bad decision on the merits with a program that so squarely looks like a contract, perhaps, when you look at the background of it. But I think this can help inform those who are setting up programs, because if you just want to give out grants as gifts, then give out grants as gifts, and then you will not be in that contract framework. And that would be, you know, less likely to come under legal attack. And you can probably do a very similar program if it doesn't fit into the contracts framework. You can also see if you can fit into the, and this is sort of an open legal question. It's interesting. I mentioned Title VII had the affirmative action program voluntary that has certain parameters. You know, EEOC has filed a brief saying, you know, 1981 should follow that model and have a similar sort of option for voluntary affirmative action programs. So that could be a way to test that out and to see if you follow that framework where it's, you know, based on some data and it's for a limited time and it does not totally bar other people from accessing it. That could be a way to try to defend such programs as voluntary affirmative action grant programs. So there's a couple of avenues, or you can go through the third way, which is probably the most legally defensible, which is not to make it race specific, but to come up with other parameters to open the doors for more people to be able to access it through your outreach, through your pipelines, through what kinds of programs you want to fund. You can find ways to provide the grants to the communities that you're looking for.
As I'm listening to you talk about this, it just keeps resonating in my mind, this idea of equity, what equity is actually intended to do. And when we think about equity in the context of correcting historical injustice, it calls to mind for me, there's a line in Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's dissent to the Students for Fair Admissions decision, where she essentially says, for anyone to claim that they're being disadvantaged or harmed by an effort to correct historical injustice for people who haven't had opportunity is itself seemingly disingenuous.
Well, let's talk about the law school context. I was just commenting on someone on a LinkedIn conversation about, you know, hiring and hiring law students. And I was saying that, even in this administration, DOJ at first had in its job postings applicants welcome from top-ranked law schools. And I emailed my friend who worked at OPM, Office of Personnel Management, and I said, is this the kind of, you know, job posting that you want to be putting out there? Who are you closing the door to? Who are you opening the door to? I'm sure many other people were, you know, activated on this as well, but I'm glad that now those job postings say applicants welcome from an accredited law school, right? That can make the difference between someone feeling like she can apply or not apply, because also, like, what does that mean? And who has access to that? Right. I'm not a first generation college student or graduate student, but I am a first generation law student. And sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Right. So there are many ways in which I did not have particular law related supports that other people had. Right. And so those are these invisible barriers that you think about maybe only after you go through an experience, right? So one of the reasons I ended up at Democracy Forward is because I saw their postings, and it was for a junior role, and it said, here are the criteria we're looking for. If you have the background, experience, and skills to do this job, but you don't have these precise criteria, please apply anyway. We'd love to hear from you. That's how you open a door with a job posting, right? And so I brought that to my last employer, and they started putting in language that says, research shows sort of men and white people tend to apply for things, even if they only have a few of the criteria. We are welcoming everyone to apply if they believe they can do this job. So there are very, like, clear, easy, legal, purely always legal ways to have more belonging, inclusion, and a wider pool. And we haven't even talked yet about outreach, right? If you're doing outreach in places where you can let people know about your organization, what you have to offer, you know, why they should come there, and bring that information to a wider pool of people. Outreach programs are completely legal. You're just getting more people in the door, right? And so there's a vast, vast array of ideas and resources for folks who want this work to continue. And I hope that others can take up the drumbeat of pushing back against this narrative that most of these programs are illegal or anything like that. To the contrary, right? The vast majority of DEI programs are wanted, legal, and should be continued.
We haven't touched too much on equitable government programs, but that is an area that you explore in the report as well. Can you say a little bit about these programs and some of the challenges that they've faced?
Since you mentioned sort of the government's role in all this, I would be remiss if I didn't mention all of the attacks on DEI in Project 2025 and the work that's going to be necessary if we are indeed faced with a hostile federal government. I mean, right now, we have this administration either involved in or intervening in or defending programs that are for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we can surely expect, if there's a hostile federal government, that that will rapidly change and that there will be a complete 180 on that, as we saw in the last administration, in terms of, you know, sort of the opposite, right? Saying, like, take out all of these programs and having them be considered not allowed instead of defending them. So I think the government's role in this is very, very important at the federal level. With the city and state level, I guess I can also talk about government boards. This is not something we focused on yet. And I'd love to highlight a case where Democracy Forward actually has intervened in Alabama. And that is with the Board of Appraisers. Different, you know, cities and states have different boards for different areas. This is a real estate related board on regarding appraisers. It both figures out sort of who can come into the profession, it handles the discipline of folks in that profession, and so on. And it has a rule that says of the 9 people, 2 should be racial minorities. And so, again, one of the opponent organizations brought a lawsuit, and the state was not going to fully defend it. And so we intervened on behalf of a local Black real estate organization. And we've already had a couple of important wins in that case. First, we were allowed to intervene. And second, the case is going on through discovery to try to defend that kind of race-specific provision when the state was not fully defending it. And so these sorts of rules and regulations exist across the country, and they're important. And if you think about it, as I said before, these are modest programs. It's 2 of 9, and it's racial minorities in general in Alabama. Right? Like, I can't even think of that as proportional in any way. It's a small gesture. But even these small gestures are coming under attack. And so I'm glad that Democracy Forward was able to be part of that fight to at least lift up that narrative that it is important to have racial minorities on a board making decisions about any profession, right? In terms of who's going to be in that space and who's going to feel like that is a job that they can have as well.
So, are there any other highlights from the report that you want to focus on and tell our audience about?
Yeah, I think the main thing is that, you know, I think sort of most of us understand that this work is about opening doors and inclusion. And I think that we are the majority, and to help each other understand the nuances of this is important so that we don't run afoul of sort of the legal parameters. But the larger message is that this work must continue. It's often people of color and organizations who are leading this work, and that is not easy to do, not always appreciated, but it is so crucial. And as with many other civil rights and DEI issues, the leadership from the top is so important. And so having that funding for programs, having that vocal leadership from those who are running organizations is so important, so that ultimately people do feel like this is a place where they want to be, whether it's a school, a healthcare setting, a workplace, or all of these different contexts.
And you mentioned a couple of times that some of the cases that you reviewed did settle. Some of them are still ongoing. What do you foresee as the future of challenges against DEI initiatives and programs?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, you know, when the report came out, it seemed to me the trend was a lot of cases were either being kicked on technical grounds and settling. Now it feels like maybe also because more time has passed, or maybe these opponents are doubling down, it feels like there's a cases coming up on appeal. Of course, what their goal is to get something to the Supreme Court and to get a decision on the merits and, you know, on these actual programs. And we'll see what happens with that. You know, when it comes to standing, I think that's interesting because that's a, you know, something that really cuts both ways, and all groups sort of need to use that when they are bringing cases forward. So that's also more interesting because I'm sort of surprised at the lengths that some of the opponents' organizations are going to on the standing question, because that is something that could equally help sort of, you know, other people with other interests in another framework. So I think more cases are going to the circuit level, and they're also not accepting when an entity says, I'll tweak the program, or we'll revise it this way, or we won't do it anymore. When in the past I saw that was the end of a case, I've seen a couple of examples of where that's now going up to the circuit still. And so we'll see what happens in the next rounds.
It will be interesting once we start to have a bigger body of cases that are being decided on the merits, which way that cuts and how that impacts things. It feels like there could be a sea change in a great way or in a not so great way. But at this moment, it's sort of like a pregnant pause, right?
Yeah. There's. I mean, every week there are more and more cases. So I think that, you know, it's really important to stay vigilant and to stay on top of it and be in community. And I should also give a shout out to all of the legacy civil rights groups. We work very closely with them to compare notes and strategies and to see how we can be helpful.
And last question, Sunu, for listeners who are interested in advocating for DEI programs, helping to improve those efforts and practices within their own organizations, what actionable steps would you recommend that people take in order to support DEI?
Well, I think sort of looking at the programs you have in place there, and you're welcome to download our report, of course, which will be linked with this, that gives you some of that framework across context. But it, you know, if you're in a state where this is really sort of under challenge in a really intense way. I understand the need to not use the same language or to tweak your program. But if you're not in a place like that, I think it's very important to keep the drumbeat going, to say diversity, equity, inclusion, and to be very vocal and supportive of these measures.
Sunu Chandy is a civil rights attorney and the senior advisor at Democracy Forward, a national legal organization that advances democracy and social progress through litigation, policy, public education, and regulatory engagement. Sunu, thank you so much for this really engaging conversation. I've learned a lot reading your report and talking to you, and I think our listeners will as well. And thank you for joining me on the DEI podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. And the last thing I'll say is I have my other life as a poet. And in my book, My Dear Comrades, I actually have poems about affirmative action and many other civil rights issues. So if you're interested, check it out. That's another way that I try to bring this work to others.
Well, maybe then one more thing, Sunu. Where can people keep up with the work that you're doing if they want to learn more about your poetry or about your advocacy?
Absolutely. Please definitely follow Democracy Forward on all of the socials. And we have a wonderful resources like the People's Guide to Project 2025 and many other resources. And for me personally, I can be found on all the socials with my name. And that's where I will post updates about both my life as a poet and also our civil rights work at Democracy Forward.
I will definitely be following you. Sunu, thank you for joining me on the DEI podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good one.
The DEI podcast at Notre Dame Law School is produced by Notre Dame Studios. Every episode, we sit down with important voices in law, culture, society, and business to talk about issues that touch all of us. If you liked what you heard today, become a subscriber and get notified every time we upload an episode. And tune in next time for another great conversation on issues that touch us all. Until then, take care.